from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. This is The Frame. I'm John Horn. The Academy Awards, with TV ratings plummeting, announces a brand new Oscar category for the best popular film. What does that mean? And Sarah Silverman is known as a pretty edgy comic, but she envisioned her Hulu series I Love You, America as a kind of Mr. Rogers Neighborhood for adults.
You know, I'm not trying to do a gentler comedy. I mean, that's the thing is, I like hard comedy, but I don't think it has to be mean to be kind of hardcore.
All that coming right up.
And the Oscar goes to...
That was Julianne Moore from a past Oscar ceremony, and maybe she'll be back next year to reveal the winner of a new award. Today, the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences announced three controversial updates to its Oscar ceremony. The main offender in the eyes of many film critics and reporters is the introduction of a new category for achievement in popular film. To discuss the matter, I called up Kyle Buchanan, a senior editor at Vulture, and I asked him what he thinks of the Academy's announcement.
I do think that the Oscars have to constantly revise and update with the times. Changing the voting body, a great idea. To me, opening up the Best Picture field, also a good idea. But a separate award for popular film, that confounds me a little bit. And I think it even confounds the Academy, because in the press release today, they didn't seem to have a concrete idea as to how people will qualify for this, what it's supposed to mean, what it's supposed to do. My fear is that it will sort of blur the lines between Best Picture and Best Hit, and that successful films that are great enough to be in the Best Picture race might not make it to over that line because the other award is seen as sort of a consolation prize.
I think that's absolutely true, and I think the history within the Academy proves it, and that is when they created the Best Animated Feature category, yeah. You had some of the best movies of the year in absolute terms. I'm thinking of Inside Out as a good example, relegated to the animation category because the thinking was, well, they've got their own category. And I think the potential outcome for this is a movie like Black Panther doesn't get in the Best Picture race because it goes into the Best Popular Film category.
Well, I know that there's a lot of consternation in the Black Panther camp today because that's what they're worried about. I mean, I think that Black Panther, up until today, had a terrific chance at Oscar nominations across the board, and I still think it will get them. But I do have that fear. I do think that it won't be taken as seriously as a piece of art because there's an Oscar meant to reward how much money it made. And the irony to me, John, is that in recent years, especially because the Academy has become hipper and more youthful, those movies get in by their own volition simply by being good. Last year, we had Get Out and Dunkirk, two of the biggest box office phenomenons of the year in the Best Picture race. And just a few years ago, the most awarded movie on Oscar night was Mad Max Fury Road. I mean, to my mind, the system is already working. I don't know that it needs to be bent just so that we can let a Transformers movie in.
Justin Chang at the LA Times called the news the, quote, best achievement in pandering. And Manola Dargis at the New York Times used some salty language and called it pathetically desperate change. Part of the thing that I think Manola's referencing is the desperation in the Academy. This year's ceremonies were the lowest rated in Academy history. And you mentioned opening up the Best Picture race from 5 to as many as 10 movies. How much of this do you think is driven by the ratings and trying to make sure people who may not be interested in the Academy Awards tune in?
I mean, all of it is, but that's the folly to me. I mean, traditional television ratings go down for every program across the board every year because of the rise of streaming services and online competition. There's not a lot you can do to reverse that trend. And I mean, I understand why they would want to make the Oscars more attractive to young people, but I'm not sure that they've come up with the right ways to do that. I think they're more interested in who's hosting. Does it seem fun? Like, has there been a good ad campaign for it? There's a weird sort of self-loathing element to these new rules, in my opinion, where, you know, to honor a popular film is essentially saying, we know, we really like unpopular films, and we're ashamed of that.
Yeah, and the whole popularity question to me is a little confounding. We have the People's Choice or the MTV Movie Awards, even the Golden Globes, that are much more populist. The Academy Awards are about the best achievement in filmmaking. And I think once you start blurring the lines between best picture and best popular film, it almost is a tacit admission that you're changing the rules for that other category. And I also thought that was part of the whole diversity initiative within the Academy, that not only do you have the Oscar so white problem, but if you bring in younger, more diverse voters, they're going to recognize films that might appeal to a younger, more diverse audience. So haven't they already tried to fix that problem? And as you mentioned, there are already a lot of really popular films like Get Out and Dunkirk that win Oscars.
Yeah, and to add another Oscar on top of that just seems fruitless. I don't know. I mean, you know as well as I do, John, that even the Golden Globes, which have a separate category for comedy, a lot of filmmakers like Jordan Peele last year, who directed Get Out, they bristle when their film is designated a comedy because they consider that to be the lesser category.
And I think you and I know that Hollywood loves cliffhangers. And to me, the big cliffhanger here is how is this category going to be defined? Is it box office numbers? Is it budget? I mean, what does that mean, a popular film? Because there are plenty of people who love movies like the Fred Rogers documentary or the
Right.
notorious RBG. Those films are incredibly popular with their audience, but they don't set box office records.
I have to think it's probably going to be a box office benchmark. And if you make more than $100 million, let's say, you're eligible for this Oscar. And it just blows my mind that the Oscars are going to actually institute a rule like that. It's just a counter to what we watch the Oscars for. And if they had some sort of idea as to how that award is supposed to work, what the qualifications for it are, well, then maybe I'd have an iota more trust in them. But they clearly don't. They're floating it out there, expecting a great reaction, and they did not get that today.
Definitely true. Kyle Buchanan is a senior editor at Vulture. Kyle, as always, thanks for coming on the show.
Nice to talk to you.
Coming up, how Sarah Silverman turned her fears about the election of Donald Trump into a show about love. Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. And just a quick reminder that you can always get The Frame as a daily podcast. You can find it wherever you like to listen. In one recent episode, you'll meet Ron Stallworth. He's the black police officer who went undercover to infiltrate the KKK in the 1970s.
I never lost sight of the fact, in spite of the many times that my sergeant and I would be cracking up laughing at the idiocy of these fools. We never lost sight of the fact that they represented an organization of hate, an organization that was has been defined as domestic terrorists. They were carrying guns. They were gun nuts. So we knew that these guys were armed or had the means to be armed at any time. If something had jumped off, gunplay was a possibility.
His memoir, Black Klansman, is now a feature film directed by Spike Lee, produced by Jordan Peele, and starring John David Washington. You can hear Stallworth and Washington talking about this story and its resonance today on The Frame podcast. And now let's turn to my conversation with comedian and actress Sarah Silverman. Her Hulu series, I Love You, America, returns for a second season in September. The first season was recently nominated for an Emmy for Outstanding Variety Sketch Series. Here's a clip from the big musical number that kicked off the first episode.
I love you men, I love you women, I love straights and I love gays. I love all the Americans from places far away. I love you if you're Haitian or Korean or Irish. I love that you're Mexican and I love that you're from Canada,
North Carolina.
Carolina. I love black people, I love whites and Asians too. I love Latinos, Muslims, Christians.
Her show was born out of this time in our country when divisions, ideological, political, cultural, seemed to be running deeper than ever. Silverman, who has not been shy about her own politics, hopes to bridge some of those divides through humor and empathy. I recently caught up with Silverman while she was on a break from work on season 2 of I Love You, America.
We just started writing, and we're going to start shooting field pieces in a couple weeks. And
what did you take away from the first season about what worked, what didn't, what you want to do more of? Do you feel like you learned what you needed to learn? Did you feel like it came out the way you wanted it to come out?
It did come out the way I wanted it to come out. We're kind of streamlining it this year. I mean, I think to do 10 shows, I'm so happy with them. But, you know, with this kind of show, you need at-bats, you know. You're constantly, I'm a slow honer, you know, so I need a lot of that, a lot of, you know, chances. But I learned so much in that first season. I mean, I'm changed, I think, kind of fundamentally as a person with each episode. I mean, I learned quickly that nobody is changed by facts or poll numbers, stuff like that, especially right now where we're getting our facts from different places, you know.
And some of them aren't facts, but yes.
And some of them aren't facts. But in terms of the show, the things I learned is that people are only changed or open from feelings. And I don't know if you've seen this Mr. Rogers documentary.
I have.
It's phenomenal.
Morgan Neville's is amazing. What did you take away from that?
He's my number one. He's my number one hero. And the show really came about because of my adoration of him and wanting and feeling like we need a Mr. Rogers for adults. And what are adults but kids plus time? A little more closed, a little more scarred. And the things he said, like everything we are has to do with love or the lack of it. That's everything. I mean, when you see the choices people make in life, it's always because they're going towards where the love is, whether that's an extremist group or a hate group or a men's rights, you know, activist thing or a wonderful thing, you know, whatever it is. But people just go towards where the love is. And that's why when you go towards people with love, even people you disagree with, you have a better chance to connect and see yourselves in each other than to just sling vitriol and be right. I do see a lot of and I try to keep myself in check on it, of like, it's almost like righteousness porn, you know? And it's nice to be right, but it's even better to connect.
Well, one of the things that's amazing about Fred Rogers is that he was an ordained priest. Mm-hmm. And I think he really saw that show as his ministry. And it wasn't as if he was giving sermons, but he was teaching parables. And a lot of what he was teaching was about reconciliation, about bringing people together. That at a time when swimming pools couldn't be segregated, he put his feet in the water with a black actor who was playing a police officer, no less. And I think that is part of what seems to inform your show, that if you're trying to build bridges as opposed to tear them apart, even if you're not saying to people, we're building this bridge, people kind of might get what you're working toward.
I think if you can see the best in someone, there's a better chance that they might see the best in themselves and be changed. I'm not saying I'm going around changing people, not at all. I'm most certainly changed by this experience. And it sounds so serious. It's extremely silly as well. And the challenge of bringing kind of hard comedy into this earnest love fest has been really, for me, exciting, you know, to be just so aggressively dumb and my favorite kind of comedy, just so silly and then also so earnest, you know. It has been really a cool challenge.
I want to play something that is from an early episode. It might be the first episode. It's where you visit a family outside of New Orleans. Chalmette, is that the?
Chalmette, yeah.
And these are all Trump supporters, and you have a conversation with them about their politics, about President Obama, and other topics. Let's listen to a little bit of what you talked to them about.
All right, new topic, gay marriage. How do we feel?
All for it. Love is love in all of our eyes. We don't judge. We love no matter what. It's completely normal.
I don't think they should have kids.
Why?
What?
A man and a woman, should raise a kid, not
who's
two
raising
men
these kids? This whole
women
household is.
You gotta defend it if you say.
Yeah, I mean, the way I was raised, you know?
That's always a good reason. Just the way I was raised.
Everybody got their own opinion, you know?
That's true. You're right.
I'm just saying anything can happen and you should be open to love no matter where it comes from.
I hate to tell you this, but you're a liberal.
I want to ask you more about this family. There's a conversation you have with them about government assistance and how they're against it, and they're all on some version of government health care. But when you think about what an audience takes away from the conversation that you're having with this family, what do you hope they see, and how do you hope their minds might be changed or they look at a family like this differently?
You know, there was obviously irony and that they were so against Obamacare, but pretty much all on it. And I think some people were like, why didn't you correct them and I let it lie there because I felt like it was evident. And, you know, the thing that they said they took away from it was they were surprised that they didn't feel judged. And I think that's the biggest fear with people on the right, with people on the left. You know, and I don't think you have to judge people to kind of illuminate your differences. And, you know, I have very strong opinions, obviously. I'm not, tamping them down to talk, but I see so much fighting, and it's just everyone has these walls up, and it's just, we're just yelling in echo chambers, and it doesn't accomplish anything.
When you're thinking about putting the show together, how much did you think about the conventions of the talk show, what you liked, what you could kind of parody, what you wanted to do away with? Because in some ways, you're celebrating certain aspects of that format, even as you're totally subverting them.
Yeah, I don't really know how to categorize the show. It's, the monologue's pretty long. We're going to do a cold open this year, and the cold open will be like of the news of that day. So it will be really current and kind of more urgent. And then the monologues are always talk about the symptoms of how we are where we're at. And then we do a field piece or a sketch. Like last year we did, a sketch where I bumped into Jesus at a Quiznos and played by Fred Armisen. And, it's just kind of different ways to look at what's going on in our lives and coping with it.
Comedian Sarah Silverman's Hulu show I Love You, America debuted in October of last year, and now it's been nominated for an Emmy for Best Variety Sketch Series. The show is, of course, meant to be funny, but Silverman also envisioned it as a sort of Mr. Rogers neighborhood for grown-ups. I Love You, America was also partly her attempt to mend our fractured country, which grew even more polarized during and after the 2016 presidential election. Silverman, who was a vocal supporter of Bernie Sanders, had backed Hillary Clinton after she won the nomination. We'll pick up my conversation with Silverman after this clip from season one of I Love You, America.
On election night, when it was finally official and Trump had won, I felt something I'd never felt before, which was this overwhelming survival-based fear. You know, I had the sudden urge to buy a gun and stockpile water and weapons and canned goods. And in an instant, I basically became a liberal doomsday prepper. I really did. Like, I suddenly needed a vest with, like, 1,000 pockets. And for the first time, I felt an actual kinship to the far-right militia person who, you know, thought Obama would end the world. You know, I might as well build a bunker and sleep in there, but, you know, I need so many creams, and it's a whole process. It wouldn't work. But I realized it's that feeling of fear that makes us the same.
You talk a little bit about feelings and about how feelings connect people more than facts. But if people have political views that are different from your own, how do you end up sharing common ground on feelings?
Well, one thing that Mr. Rogers, actually, he didn't say this. He quoted someone, a woman, who said, "There isn't anyone we couldn't love once we've heard their story." And I think that's true of all of us, and that's kind of the place where I try to come from in this. And, you know, with the guests that we've had, they're all people who have been changed in some way. And, you know, I think about it a lot. Like, we had a guest, Christian Piccolini, who was a neo-Nazi skinhead and changed, and now helps people get out of hate groups. And when I asked him for advice, he said, "Find someone who doesn't deserve your compassion and give it to them, because that's what happened to me." You know, someone did that for him. And then I wonder, like, if I met him before he changed, would I see the potential in him for change?
And that happens with another guest, and that is the woman who is raised in the Westboro Baptist Church of Fred
Megan Phelps-Roper, yeah.
Who is raised in a church that whose hatred is beyond categorization. And she meets somebody who basically says there might be another way of looking at it. And her mind is changed by this person who doesn't judge her, but says, maybe there's a different way of thinking, or have you ever looked at this situation in this way?
I mean, growing up in the Westboro Baptist Church, where they're, I mean, it's this tiny community, but they're totally self-sufficient, and they've got, and it's any one of us who, if we grew up there, would have been her, you know? It was all she knew. It was everything she loved. They'd go to, you know, soldiers' funerals with "God hates fags," you know, posters. I mean, the whole thing. And when social media became a big thing, they wanted to get the word out, and they put Megan in charge of their social media. And, of course, people came at her with vitriol and everything. I mean, this Westboro Baptist Church is just pretty heinous. But a couple people came towards her with love, and she engaged with them, and it changed her life.
We're talking with Sarah Silverman about her show, I Love You, America. When you meet somebody like that, or meet somebody who grows up as a neo-Nazi and changes his view of the world, how does that change you?
I feel like we are all so similar, and I think dividing ourselves is like a way to define who we are, you know? Father Gregory Boyle, he was on the show. He's a Jesuit priest who started Homeboy Industries, and he's incredible, and he said something like, if we don't make peace with our wounds, we will be tempted to despise the wounded. And isn't that all of us in various degrees of ways? And it really, I think about it so often, and it affects so many parts of my life, you know? I'm so grateful for the people I've gotten to talk to and everything. And boy, this show doesn't sound funny at all.
It sounds like Oprah.
I promise it is. It's pretty ridiculous. We sandwich anything heady with real ridiculousness.
How does comedy fit into all of this, not only on your show, but also in stand-up? Because so much of comedy historically today is about putting other people down, laughing at somebody else's expense. And what you're talking about is that it's better to be for something, it's better to understand somebody than to ridicule somebody. So given the traditions of comedy and stand-up, how do we think about ways that comedy could work differently?
There's a lot of different comedy, and what is funny is always changing. And and the world is always changing. And, you know, it's just like how they say you can go see the same painting at a gallery every single day. And what changes is the world around you and your personal life and experience, and the world's experience changes what you see in the art, you know, changes what it means. And so I think that, you know, comedy changes, and, you know, I'm not trying to do a gentler comedy. I mean, that's the thing is, I like hard comedy, but I don't think it has to be mean to be kind of hardcore.
Sarah Silverman is the host, writer, and field correspondent on I Love You, America. It's on Hulu. It comes back in September. Sarah, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Nice to see you, too. Thank you.
You can find the first season of Sarah Silverman's I Love You, America on Hulu. And that'll do it for today. Remember to keep up with us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Come back tomorrow for more. We'll be right back.